Some inner worm started to torment me. Something has to be done. I started to write short leaflets that I planned to mail out. But later, having thought it out properly, I understood this was a useless undertaking. To establish contact with dissident circles, which have contact with foreign journalists, seemed senseless to me. Due to the nature of my work, I have top secret clearance. Based on the slightest suspicion, I would be totally isolated or liquidated. Thus was born my plan of action, to which I have resorted. That is Adolf Tolkachev writing to his CIA handlers, describing how he chose to become a spy and his drive to destroy the Soviet Union from within. Welcome to The Rest Is Classified. I'm Gordon Carrera.
I'm David McCloskey. And this is the story, Gordon, as you mentioned, of Adolf Tolkachev, who I think we could say might have been or probably was the most valuable CIA spy in Moscow during the Cold War.
Or Moscow, I should say.
Moscow?
Moscow, rather than Moscow. But anyway, keep going.
I've been told it's more of an Acton accent. Is that right, Gordon?
No, just keep going. Sorry to interrupt.
So he's the most valuable spy in Moscow in the 1980s. He's an expert on Soviet radar, whose intelligence was valued, and this is insane, valued by the U.S. government at around $2 billion. So he is the billion-dollar spy, which is also the title of an exceptional work on Tolkachev by a man named David Hoffman, and we'll be drawing extensively on that book as we tell this story. But this, Gordon, I think is a story of really the height of the Cold War, this battle between the CIA and the KGB, this kind of spy war that's going on at the absolute apex of the Cold War in the middle of the 1980s. And it is, Gordon, I think, to kind of get the zeitgeist. In 1984, it is The Hunt for Red October, which is the film adaptation of the Tom Clancy novel by the same name, is coming out, and it comes out right as the CIA is in the middle of running Adolf Tolkachev as a spy. And in that film, as in the book, you know, we have these the superpowers sort of competing for military primacy. There is a battle over the technology that is going to provide an advantage in the Cold War. And of course, in Red October, we have Captain Marco Ramius, who's sort of wonderfully played by Sean Connery.
Although with a slightly dodgy accent, I should say, in that film, which is a theme of our podcast as well. Anyway.
Was The Hunt for Red October, did that do well in the UK?
Yeah,
Gordon?
It did.
Did that sort of impact the 80s in the UK as it did here?
I think he didn't quite play it with the Russian accent, but anyway.
He didn't have the accent that you did when you were reading that Tolkachev quote.
Thank you.
Front.
I didn't try.
Yes, that's a proper Moscow accent. And of course, in the novel Hunt for Red October, as in the movie, we have the Soviets have this what's called a caterpillar drive on their subs that make them very quiet and undetectable by U.S. sonar. And so we have this sort of battle over technology, and Sean Connery is this disillusioned Soviet captain whose wife has died at the hands of an incompetent doctor, and he's this sort of defector from within on the Soviet system, and he's trying to bring this technology to the United States so the United States can have it and give Washington an advantage in the Cold War. And what I think is incredible about the Tolkachev story is that we have, I think, in the person of Adolf Tolkachev, someone who's actually quite similar to Marco Ramius, the Sean Connery character, in that he, Tolkachev, is a member of the Soviet elite. He is a radar engineer and technician and designer who is working on, you know, cutting-edge Soviet aviation technology. And he, like Connery, has this burning desire to wreck the Soviet Union from within.
Yeah, and I think what also is interesting about this is it does have, even though it's a story of Cold War, high Cold War espionage, it's still got a real contemporary relevance because, I mean, one of the things that we've heard the CIA and MI6 directors saying recently is that they're open for business from disillusioned officials in Moscow who want to spy for Western intelligence. And they've been putting out, you know, videos on Telegram, on social media, providing instructions of how, if you like, to contact the CIA and to provide intelligence. So this story, though, gives a sense, I think, of just how hard it is to run an agent in Moscow.
under the eyes of Russian intelligence and the Russian security services, then the KGB, now the FSB, and just the challenges involved in that, but the centrality and the importance of those human sources which are at the heart of this business.
Well, and I think this is where, again, so much of the detail that we're going to talk about here, it comes from that wonderful book by David Hoffman, The Billion Dollar Spy, because he gets into, by virtue of having access to much of the cable traffic from inside CIA about this case, he gets into the nitty-gritty, kind of the details of very specifically, how do you run an asset in Moscow, right? How do you communicate? How do you pass information? How do you pass goods? Where do people store their spy gear? How do you take photographs? I mean, this is one of those cases where we really have a light shown on the practical realities of running a spy in Moscow. Now, of course, this is a case from the 80s. The tradecraft has changed, but a lot of the fundamentals around communication and around, as we'll see, how do you detect surveillance, there's been adaptations and evolutions, but a lot of the basic principles are still the same. And so I think listeners will get a real picture here of just how kind of end-to-end the CIA runs and recruits a human asset in Russia. Now, Adolf Tolkachev, the man who will become the billion-dollar spy, he literally drops into CIA's lap. And I think this is something also that listeners may be a little surprised at, which is, at the end of the day, there are a very, very small number of human assets that really pay all the bills at CIA or probably any other intelligence service. You'd be surprised at just how few of them there are, and how the ones that are really valuable are essentially covering the budget for the entire agency in terms of their value. And interestingly, those types of assets almost always volunteer. They are very rarely sort of recruited over this kind of long, painstaking process of trying to convince them. They tend to drop in our laps to some degree. And that is the case with Adolf Tolkachev. Now, what happens here is it is January of 1977 in Moscow. The best time of year to visit Moscow, I'm told, is in January. It is very cold. The CIA's station chief in Moscow is filling his car up with gas at kind of one of these stations that are reserved for, you know, foreign diplomats and officials. And a mystery man, who's Adolf Tolkachev, walks up and asks if the chief of station is American. Now, he can tell from the diplomatic plates that the man is American, but he wants to confirm. And the man who walks up, this guy, Tolkachev, he's got brown hair. He's got a crook in his nose from a kind of boyhood hockey accident. He's got a very broad forehead. And he kind of reminds me, and I don't know, Gordon, if this will resonate with our British listeners, he reminds me a little bit of Herman Munster from The Munsters. He's got very distinctive features and a very big forehead.
I have to say, when I looked at pictures of him, and people can look those up if they want to see him, he doesn't look like your kind of top research scientist to me. He doesn't look like the nerdy research scientist. He's got that kind of broken nose. He looks more like a boxer. He looks more like the kind of the thug, the kind of hired help you'd expect working for the kind of KGB or something like that in their stereotype, rather than, if you like, this quite intense and clearly very clever engineer.
That is right. He's got a tough look to him. And, you know, he is an active outdoorsman, loves fishing, loves hunting, loves being out at his dacha in the countryside. You know, he runs in the mornings. He likes to ski. He's an outdoors guy. He's an active guy. And, you know, at this point, though, what's interesting, and we'll come to this later on, is the agency doesn't know who he is, and they have absolutely no idea why in the world he is contacting the chief of station. And we'll get to that. So Tolkachev later is going to say, and this comes from the CIA has done some unclassified write-ups on Tolkachev. Tolkachev later notes that he had decided that the driver of the car he chose to approach had to be an American and not a Russian chauffeur due to his, quote, bright and beggarly clothing, trousers which had never seen an iron. No Russian chauffeur of a diplomatic vehicle would ever dress like that. So in other words, the chief of station was dressed so low rent that Tolkachev figured he could not be driving a well-placed Russian around. So Tolkachev puts a piece of paper in the front seat and walks away. CIA, again, doesn't know his name, doesn't know anything about him. And later in the station, the chief of station reads the note. Tolkachev basically, quite vaguely, says, "I want to discuss matters on a strictly confidential basis with an appropriate American official. And Tolkachev then suggests a discreet meeting at a given time and place in the car of an American official at like a metro station entrance.
I mean, even that seems quite risky to me, but he's clearly thought about it, Tolkachev, and he's been planning this and has worked out that might be a secure way of meeting someone, because there still seems even risk to that, putting a note in an American's car or suggesting meeting in their car.
I think it is worth noting just how high risk these seemingly kind of innocuous things are. I mean, talking to an American, putting a note in the car. I mean, these are the kind of things that could ruin his entire life if he's spotted and if the KGB runs it down. I mean, at this time, Gordon, I mean, the KGB is maybe like a million strong. The vast majority of their sort of human capital of the KGB are in the Second Chief Directorate, which is internal security, watching Russians in Russia. So Tolkachev has a lot of things to worry about, but he's an engineer at heart. He's very precise. And he's got, you know, he's got sketches of the exact locations and where the car should be parked. He's clearly thought this through. And you would expect that, hey, a Russian has dropped into our lap, right? CIA would be chomping at the bit to talk to this guy. Well, the CIA is quite apprehensive. Maybe that sounds abnormal, but it's actually quite common in this period for notes to get dumped into Americans' cars. So that a note being dropped in the chief of station's window is not so crazy. It happened a lot in the summertime, Russians trying to contact Americans. And also, the KGB, Gordon, as you well know, has a long track record of entrapping Americans. The idea here being the KGB gets a CIA officer or even a diplomat, lures them into meeting with a Russian, and then expels them. And it creates massive sort of problems in the pipeline to staff Moscow station and the embassy if the KGB is booting people out.
Yeah, it's called a dangle, isn't it? And you dangle someone who's under your control as the KGB to the CIA and say, you pretend he wants to spy for them, and it allows you to identify all the CIA officers. You know, that's something both sides do to each other. So there's a natural caution about a note being passed rather than thinking, oh, great, here's a potential spy for us.
Exactly. And so, you know, there's also some stuff going on in the high level kind of bilateral relationship. This is January of 77. So the Carter administration is taking power in Washington. The incoming Secretary of State is coming to Moscow to kind of lay the basis for bilateral relationships between the US and the Russians and the new administration. And so DC, Langley, they don't want anything on the streets of Moscow to kind of complicate that. So they ignore Adolf Tolkachev. Now, Tolkachev is absolutely relentless, which is thematic in his character. He tries two more times in February of 1977. He knocks on the window of the chief of station's car. He drops papers inside. He starts to give. I think Tolkachev is realizing that the CIA needs a little bit more from him. And so he gives, in one of these notes, a bit of biographical detail that he works for what he calls a closed enterprise, which is basically a secret facility for defense work. And, you know, again, the CIA still doesn't bite. Now, there's a fourth try in May of 1977. Tolkachev had been kind of hiding in a phone booth, tries to hand off a package to the chief of station, but the chief doesn't roll down the window, drives off. CIA headquarters at Langley has instructed the chief to ignore Tolkachev. And again, you mentioned, you know, sort of dangles and expulsions on either side. A Soviet diplomat has just been expelled from New York. And CIA thinks, you know, again, the KGB is dangling someone at us to kind of retaliate in Moscow. So let's just back off this guy. So we've had four tries in the span of about 4 or 5 months. And every time he's gotten the cold shoulder from CIA.
Which must be bizarre, mustn't it? You think, I'm trying to spy for you. let me give you some top secret information. And no one seems to want to listen to it. But what's interesting is he doesn't give up, which suggests a kind of drive. And we'll get to his motivations later, but it does suggest a really kind of intense desire to do this and to take more and more risks.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I've wondered about this as we, you know, were preparing the story. Is Tolkachev confused by this response? Is he perplexed? I would imagine to some degree he is, but he's also intimately aware of how his own system functions, right? He is not kind of a country bumpkin who has no concept of sort of, you know, how Soviet power functions, right? He understands, I think, the KGB. He understands the risks in the system, and he probably understands the sort of reluctance on the part of CIA to, you know, just take the bait, as it were. And so, you know, I think he probably has some appreciation for the caution that the CIA is going to show. And I think, frankly, as we'll get in, you know, further into the story, I think it probably informs some measure of the respect he has for the cautious way that CIA will eventually run the case. Now, why all this apprehension, though? Like, I mean, there's got to be something else going on. Well, another bit of this story is that 1977 has been shaping up to be a very, very bad year in Moscow Station. So that year, the CIA loses a prized asset in Moscow, a foreign ministry official who had been recruited in Colombia and who had come back into Russia, was spying for CIA. There's probably a whole separate pod, Gordon, that we could do on this case because it's absolutely incredible. But so the CIA has lost an asset in Moscow. And this guy had actually been given a suicide pill that they'd been snuggled into a pen. When caught, he, you know, asked for the pen to write his confession, bites into it, dies. So CIA has lost this asset in dramatic fashion. CIA doesn't know at this point how this asset had been blown. In September, the CIA is going to lose another source. And then, on top of all of that, there's a new CIA director in town, of course, with the Carter administration coming in, a man who's very suspicious, I think you could say, Gordon, of CIA. His name's Admiral Stansfield Turner. He's a Navy man. He's a four-star admiral, had been commander-in-chief of Allied forces in Southern Europe. And he is, I think, deeply skeptical of the value of human intelligence. You know, there's these stories of him coming in and kind of seeing some of the first images being beamed down from spy satellites. Up to that point, it had actually been film that had been sort of floated down, picked up by planes to get developed. You know, it took a while. Now you're literally having the images kind of beamed down. Stansfield Turner calls it TV in space. And there's kind of this massive, I think, cultural and philosophical chasm between Turner and the CIA's director of operations. And Turner also has really kind of roughed up CIA in his first year in office.
And so with that context in mind, Tolkachev is trying and he's pushing against the door, which seems pretty firmly closed. So he realizes he's got to give them something more, doesn't he, to actually convince CIA that he is the real deal and not some kind of dangle, and that he's worth, I guess, taking a risk on.
In that context, you know, Tolkachev doesn't know any of this, but he's kind of asking the CIA officers in Moscow to take a pretty big risk in their system. Because also, I mean, the other bit of context here we should add on 1977 is that there's a fire at the embassy in Moscow, the US embassy, and no one quite knows at the time how it was started, but it's believed that the Soviets send KGB firemen up to try to put it out. And the chief of station literally kind of stands in the door to prevent these KGB officers from going into Moscow Station. So it kind of, the CIA is adding all of this stuff up and saying, okay, do we have a mole? Are the Soviets, you know, wise to some of our tradecraft in Moscow? Is the KGB reading our comms? And all of this culminates at the end of the year with Stansfield Turner, the CIA director, essentially ordering a freeze in clandestine operations in Moscow until they can guarantee no more compromises, which, of course, to these, you know, DO, Director of Operations officers, it sounds insane. But they've got this diktat from the CIA's seventh floor that basically says no operations, just kind of stand down. So Tolkachev is really asking a lot of these Moscow Station officers, who I think probably would have behaved more aggressively on the case, if given the chance, they're being asked to sort of, you know, hold back and kind of let the Tolkachev thing play out without doing much. It is December of 1977. It has been almost a year since Adolf Tolkachev first tried to make contact with CIA, and he has still not had a single meeting other than these sort of bumps with CIA officers on the streets of Moscow. And Tolkachev, as we had said, is a relentless character. And he tries again, even in the middle of this stand down in Moscow Station, which of course he doesn't know about, but he is going to push through. And what Tolkachev does in December of 77 is he essentially replays the initial drop that he had made on the chief of station back in January. He goes to a gas station, again, one frequented by foreign diplomats, finds an American diplomatic car. This time it's not the chief of station. It's the major domo of Spasibo House, which is where the U.S. ambassador lives in Moscow. And a major domo, Gordon, is that a Downton Abbey reference? I think I've seen that kind of person sort of downstairs. Is that right?
So they run the house. Is that what
he runs
that,
the house?
Yeah, the house being the U.S. ambassador's residence,
not Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey. Yes. Okay, got it.
And the majordomo takes the information into the embassy, gives it to the ambassador. It sort of works its way through the embassy system, gets to the CIA. And what Tolkachev has provided is two typewritten pages of intelligence about Soviet military radars. And this is coming on the heels of a Soviet MiG pilot who had actually defected to Japan with the aircraft. And Tolkachev says that that MiG-25, that the technicians inside the Soviet system after the defection are now furiously reworking the radar configuration. And Tolkachev also says that he has the schematics for what's called a look-down, shoot-down radar, LDSD, which is not a psychedelic drug, but is in fact a really interesting piece of military intelligence that the CIA and the Pentagon, you know, sort of official Washington, would be really keen to know. And Gordon, it's basically a capability that would allow Soviet planes at very high altitude to spot planes or missiles flying below. And that is, I mean, it sounds a little bit, I guess, technical, but basically what it is it would close what the Americans see as kind of a key gap in Soviet coverage, which is that during a U.S. sort of missile bomb strike, nuclear strike, whatever, the U.S. could fly missiles or bombers at low altitudes and they would be invisible to Soviet radar. So the Soviets are sort of working to close this gap, and Tolkachev is sort of dangling in front of CIA that he might have intelligence on specifically how they're trying to close that gap.
So we don't need to get too deep into the technicals of it, but it's clearly in the world of kind of Cold War technology, as you were saying at the start with Hunt for Red October, this is a kind of key capability which the Soviets are developing, which the US wants to know about. So Tolkachev has given them something which I guess he knows will be of great interest to the CIA and to Washington. And that's what's got him over the line, or what gets him over the line, isn't it? It's the clear proof that he's got something of value to them rather than just being a dangle or someone trying to offer them low-grade stuff.
And this is where you do start to see the tenor of the case flipping and kind of, you know, the CIA starts to perk up. But Tolkachev hasn't really given them schematics or specs yet. He's just said, I have these. And he's been able to describe it in kind of enough detail to sound believable. And, you know, I think it's sort of a fascinating window into just how there's kind of this push and pull between Moscow station and then these more risk-averse forces at CIA headquarters, because there's a back and forth in the cable traffic over the next few weeks, which again, the Hoffman book, Billion Dollar Spy, kind of wonderfully lays out, which is that, you know, Moscow station is essentially saying, let us do something and meet with this guy, try to get in touch with him. And there's a memo that basically says, okay, there's two options, which I love because frankly, it defies the famous advice from Henry Kissinger, I believe, that you should always have three options, you know, an A, B, and a C, and sort of the middle ground is the one you want the policymaker to choose. But there's only two in this case. Option B is let's go ahead and meet with him. And what do you think option A is, Gordon? What's your guess on what the proposal is there?
Do nothing.
do nothing.
Too
risky. You know, it's too risky. It could lead to another expulsion, prolong the stand down. The CIA, there's sort of this hand-wringing of, you know, Tolkachev might have initially been sort of genuine, but now he's being monitored by the KGB and we're being set up. And, you know, this is another bit of it, which we alluded to earlier, is like the CIA station in Moscow is not massive. The officers there are really valuable. Two case officers had been sent home the previous year. And if, you know, the KGB burns one of us meeting with this guy, we lose another. And so, again, the answer is do nothing. And Tolkachev comes back. Oh, and interestingly, sort of from a bureaucratic perspective, because I love these, Tolkachev, he's not a recruited asset yet by any means, but the CIA will still give developmentals a kind of a cryptonym. And so he is encrypted as CK Sphere. You'll remember, Gordon, from our wonderful journeys through coup attempts in Iran, that in the 50s, the sort of digraph, those first two letters of the case for Ajax were TP Ajax. Here, CK denotes a Soviet division case, and Sphere is kind of Tolkachev's cryptonym. So he'll be known and kind of talked about inside Station, inside Langley, as Sphere.
But they've given him the cryptonym, but they're still not. He's still banging his head against the wall, almost literally. And he doesn't give up.
He does not give up. It is February of 1978. He has been at this for over a year. Tolkachev shoves another note through another car window. And in it, this time, he includes, and this is where I think Tolkachev is, he's many things. He's highly creative. And he includes in it his phone number. He excludes the last two digits. He says, I'll be on a certain street corner. And he's got a little diagram of where he'll be, holding a plywood board with the last two numbers on a particular date. And so he's giving the CIA a way to contact him.
Again, can I just say that someone standing up with a plywood board with two numbers on it would seem to me to be the most suspicious thing in Moscow. And yet this is his kind of clever way of not giving, you know, giving the last two digits of his phone number to them. I mean, it works. So I guess he knows what he's doing, but it's just interesting how people come up with these slightly what appear to be crazy ideas.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. If I reflect on, if I were standing on a street corner with numbers on a plywood board, it might draw more attention rather than less. I suppose it depends on how big the board is, how big the numbers maybe are. And this is another, I think, fascinating window into the bureaucratic machinery that propels these kind of cases. Because all along, you know, CIA headquarters has been saying, brush him off, don't do anything, there's a stand down. And finally, what happens at around the time that Tolkachev has given his instructions about the plywood board is that the Pentagon has kind of been looking through some of the initial stuff from Tolkachev, and they express interest. There's a memo that gets sent from the Pentagon to CIA where the Pentagon expresses an interest in intelligence on Soviet radars. And this starts to tip the balance. And it's a very common, I think, feature of how CIA sort of prioritizes and thinks about what kind of operations it is going to do or approve. Is the CIA is very customer driven. And so if an outside agency, particularly a senior customer at Pentagon or at the White House or the State Department, says, I really want something on X, that starts to give CIA collectors out in the field air cover to go and do these things, right? To produce that kind of intelligence. And so with the Pentagon being interested, now all of a sudden things flip. The CIA gets a green light to reach out and they follow Tolkachev's instructions. They get the phone number and they call twice from public phone booths in Moscow, but both times Tolkachev's wife answers and so they hang up.
And so it's still not worked. So despite the plywood boards, everything else, but at least now they're trying. At least now they finally got the message and they're trying to reach out to him. And he's still trying to get hold of them, yeah?
And he's still trying. So in March, Tolkachev finds the chief of station again. And he slips a packet of taped paper into the chief of station's hands. And at last here, Tolkachev reveals his identity and gives some information on his background to establish his bona fides. So the note has the P.O. box of the institute where he worked, which identifies him as an employee of the Scientific Research Institute for Radio Engineering, which is a great, wonderfully anodyne, bureaucratic kind of Soviet name. And it gives them, I think it gives CIA this kind of confidence that they can actually put an officer of the Central Intelligence Agency kind of out to start interacting with Tolkachev. And so at last here, in the spring of 1978, well over a year after Tolkachev's initial bump, the man who's going to become Tolkachev's kind of first case officer actually goes to the Bolshoi Ballet. He's at a performance of Anna Karenina. He goes out during the intermission and calls the number, calls Tolkachev at home, uses a code name, says it's Nikolai, says, hey, we've gotten all your letters and we want to contact you.
So it looks like contact is finally being made. Maybe this is a good point to just look at who Adolf Tolkachev really is. I mean, we know he's driven and relentless. We know he's an engineer, but what is driving him? I mean, what's his motivation in wanting to take what are extraordinary risks, you know, with his life to do this?
Yeah, Tolkachev is, I find him to be a really fascinating psychological case because, so he's 50 when he raises his hand to work for CIA in 1977. A bit on him. I mean, he's a loner, doesn't have many friends, although that seems, again, from a lot of these cables that Hoffman cites in his book, you know, you get the sense that it's not because he's desperately trying to make friends. It's that he's sort of withdrawn in many ways. He's, you know, he's an introvert. He and his wife and his teenage son live in a very comfortable high-rise apartment in central Moscow, which is actually quite close to the U.S. Embassy. It's kind of filled with the upper crust of Soviet rocketry and aviation. So there's a lot of engineers in his building. There's a lot of pilots in the crawl space, in the kitchen, kind of in a where he's got all his camping equipment. We talked about him as an, you know, a very kind of outdoorsy person. He's also going to stash all of his spy gear there. Interestingly, his wife, Natasha, he says, you know, she's never going to find it there because she's very short and I guess unable to actually get even on a chair to kind of reach the crawl space. No one has any interest in going there. He is very devoted to his wife. And he actually tells CIA in one of these notes that he's the kind of person who's only destined to fall in love once.
And his wife, it's fair to say, is an important part of his motivation and his story, isn't it? I mean, in terms of why he's become disillusioned with the Soviet Union and why he wants to do something about that disillusionment as well.
I think it's fair to say that the roots of the treason are in his wife Natasha's family line, because Natasha's mom, so what would have been Tolkachev's mother-in-law, had actually been shot during the terror in the 1930s.
Under Stalin.
Oh yeah, Stalin's terror, these sort of purges of the Moscow elite that happened in the 1930s. So Natasha's mother's shot. Her father goes to prison camp when Natasha's a toddler because he hadn't denounced his wife. And so Natasha, Tolkachev's wife, grows up in state orphanages and actually did not see her father again until she was 18 in 1953 after Stalin dies. And so she has essentially grown up an orphan thanks to Stalin and his terror and the Soviet system. And so I think Tolkachev and his wife Natasha are ideological defectors from the Soviet system, probably from a very young age. And, you know, interestingly enough, Tolkachev doesn't tell his wife what he's up to, but I think it's fair to say that she would have probably agreed with his desire to inflict maximum damage on the Soviet system. And in fact, at one point, just as sort of a familial side note in the story, Natasha's going to find some of the spy gear that Tolkachev will end up getting and tell him, you know, you got to cut this out. I mean, you know, we're all going to go through hell if you get caught. But she doesn't, it's not like she's going to inform on him. She doesn't raise it again. And Tolkachev, of course, doesn't stop. So they never talk about it again.
So, I mean, the roots are quite deep and familial. But by the 70s, you've got the dissident movement. You've got a sense of kind of disillusionment, haven't you, with the Soviet Union? It feels like that then leads him somehow, maybe at that point in life, to action, to actually trying to do something about it.
Yeah, I think that this kind of elite opposition, frankly, coming from academics and writers, you know, think of Alexander Solzhenitsyn is writing in this time, and Tolkachev is very aware of him and desperately wants to read his stuff. You know, I think Tolkachev realizes that something needs to be done, you know, and in the quote that you read in your wonderful Russian accent, Gordon, at the beginning of this episode.
My Sean Connery Russian accent.
Your Marco Ramius Russian accent. You know, Tolkachev says, there's this inner worm that started to torment me and something had to be done. And I think, you know, Tolkachev had kind of toys around with, do I write a dissident pamphlet and put something out? And I think there's an important bit on his psychology here, Gordon, which is, it's pretty stock and trade in CIA to say that somebody volunteering to become a spy or being convinced to become a spy is a bit of a psychological outlier. You're not a normal person if you're willing to betray the system that has brought you up, and if you're willing to essentially give state secrets to, you know, a foreign actor, like there's probably something a little wrong with you. And I think, although I applaud sort of Tolkachev's desire to see Soviet communism destroyed, I think he's a bit of an egotist too, because you think about, you know, he's a nobody engineer is thinking about writing dissident pamphlets, you know, so I think he's got a sense that he's absolutely right. And he is a man who is sort of destined to change history, to do what he can to bring down the Soviet system.
Yeah, normal people don't spy, as someone puts it. And I mean, to have the desire to do it, to take the risks, and as we've seen, to be so relentless, you know, in his pursuit of the CIA, frankly, despite their apparent, you know, lack of interest, I think does suggest something, you know, very unusual.
And I think, you know, Gordon, we sort of painted this picture of a guy who's, he's got this deep family opposition to the Soviet system. I mean, a little bit like Marco Ramius, you know, who's lost his wife because this sort of corruption inside the Soviet system, and his wife has died. And yet, I think a key event in his sort of progression to becoming a spy is that in 1976, about a year before he first volunteers, that Soviet pilot defects with a plane, with a MiG, to Japan. And the Soviet authorities begin ordering Tolkachev's institute to redesign the radar. And so Tolkachev sees, I think, in that set of events, that his greatest weapon isn't going to be writing a pamphlet, but it's going to be giving the institute's research to an enemy of the Soviet system, the United States.
So he's realized he's got something that can do real damage. So he's got the motivation and he's got the access and he's got this kind of amazing kind of relentless desire to do damage, you know, to the regime which he serves, which has led him repeatedly to contact, you know, the CIA. So we're back at this point where he's finally made contact with them. And now let's look at it from the, I guess, from the CIA's point of view, having looked at it from Tolkachev's point of view. They've got this potential asset, you know, someone who now they've worked out is interesting, has got real intelligence that's valuable, that their customers, as you put it, you know, want. But actually meeting someone in Moscow, I mean, this is the bit I find really fascinating, is not easy. I mean, if you are in that CIA station in Moscow, you know, that group of spies who are operating out of the embassy, you are under intense pressure, aren't you? I mean, you've got the resources of the KGB directed at watching you, keeping you under surveillance, stopping you meeting someone like Tolkachev.
I mean, you essentially have surveillance on you everywhere if you're an officer in Moscow. You know, the KGB basically knows who all of the CIA officers are, except for a very few of kind of the deep cover ones who might have kind of innocuous jobs in the embassy, like their cashiers and their clerks and things like that. And interestingly enough, these kind of deep cover people, there's Russian nationals, you know, who are on the embassy compound, of course. And so if you're one of these deep cover officers, you know, you're actually having to communicate with the station, not by going in and talking to people most of the time, but actually by inter-office dead drops because they couldn't be seen anywhere near the door.
So if you're a deep cover CIA officer in the embassy, you can't go into the CIA bit of the embassy because there are locally hired staff watching you who are Russians and you'll be reporting. So you're basically passing messages secretly within your own embassy compound. That's how hard it is.
That's right. The brief periods where you could actually go into the station, they were rare, right? And those officers really looked forward to them because, you know, they're sort of hiding, obviously, everything about their true purpose for being in Moscow from everyone around them, including the other Americans in the embassy, almost all the time. So, you know, you're watched all the time in Moscow. Gordon, you and I have a great mutual friend, former CIA operations officer named John Cipher, who has this wonderful sort of surveillance story from his time working in Moscow, which is there's a case officer, and this is after the Tolkachev case, but I think illustrates the sort of really awful, grinding nature of the surveillance in the Soviet system. There's a case officer, CIA case officer in Moscow Station. You know, he goes out running. He's a big, you know, he likes to go run around Moscow. And it's springtime. It's one of the few times in Moscow where you could actually kind of go out and enjoy the weather. And he goes out for a run, kind of unplanned, on a new route, goes running, and comes back, and a pair of his shoes are gone. Now, where did they go? Obviously, the KGB, who had been watching him, didn't like that he'd kind of gone out for this run without them being able to really know where he was going. They maybe figure he could have been operational. They're sending him a signal, don't do that anymore. So he goes, at this point in Moscow, there's a Reebok store. He goes, he buys a new pair of shoes. Those shoes get stolen. So he's kind of ticked about this. So he looks up at the ceiling and he says, hey guys, I need to run. It's what keeps me sane. Here's the route I'm going to take. Here's the generally when I'm going to go running. The next day, the shoes are there, back, put back in his apartment. Guy goes running. And of course, the KGB has these surveillance vehicles that are right there waiting for him on the route. They pop open the trunk. They get these foldable bicycles out and literally just trail him as he runs. And so you have this sense of like just everything is happening under the watchful eye of the KGB. You know, your apartment is going to be bugged. Husband and wife teams, or not even teams, but just couples who are there are going to be writing notes to each other on paper, kind of set against wood or metal, because they don't want to leave an impression on a page underneath that the KGB might come in and read. You know, and the other great kind of anecdote of Moscow in this period is that every CIA officer would become familiar with the surveillance teams that are actually watching them and would try to understand when they had surveillance and when they didn't. And sometimes they would recognize that there was another individual in one of the surveillance cars. And this was the KGB psychologist who was assigned to their case and assigned to know everything about their lives, their family, their personality, how they behave under stress, under pressure, what their schedule is. And also, I mean, sometimes it kind of flips from just being slightly humorous, like the shoe story, to being people being harassed. You know, there are stories about Americans' dogs being killed, air being let out of tires, you know, a fridge unplugged while you're gone, all the food goes bad, poop left in the toilet. Gordon, can you believe this? Well, you know, someone's out. And so it is the big leagues for the CIA, right? This is a place you want to be, surprisingly. And the environment is really rough. I mean, even the office, when we talk about the station in Moscow, it is basically a windowless rectangular box up on the embassy's seventh floor, which is, I think, the title of a new book coming out, Gordon. I'm not...
Another plug. Nicely done, sure. David.
And it's shielded in metal. It's isolated from the walls of the rest of the building. It's this very tight space. You know, we talked in the Iran episodes about music playing during an operation. So there's always music going in the station from a cassette player. And the other thing that comes out, and you talk to officers who serve there, is the dry air in Moscow was terrible. And so everything inside is overheated. So your fingers are kind of cracked and bleeding. There's big jars of Vaseline on everyone's desk, and they're sticking gobs of Vaseline up their noses all day. Even, I mean, the station itself is so isolated from the rest of the embassy that the case officers have to clean the toilets themselves, right? There's no cleaners coming in there. So there's like a sign-up sheet for cleaning duty. So this place is kind of, it's a bit of a dichotomy because it is a primo slot for a CIA officer in the 1980s. And it's also day to day, just a really miserable and grinding environment. And these are the people, this is kind of the petri dish that the team running Tolkachev is going to come out of.
Yeah. And so, as you say, this is the kind of pinnacle, if you like, of the spy game, is to be able to operate in Moscow. I mean, it's why you hear this phrase, Moscow rules, often used in terms of, you know, kind of spy jargon, and it's, you know, bled into fiction. And it's this idea that you have to have the strictest standards of your tradecraft, the way you operate, in order to be able to do anything in Moscow, to be able to deal with that kind of surveillance, to be able to run an agent like Tolkachev. And it, you know, it does sound intense. I mean, it sounds also quite unpleasant. You know, it does not sound glamorous. It's not all going to the Bolshoi and things like that. But I guess if that's the A game, if that's the highest place to play this spy game, then if you're driven, that's where you want to be, I guess. You know, you want to be in Moscow and to do it because of the intensity of it and because of what's at stake, because you're up against the kind of toughest adversary you could be battling. And, you know, here we are with Tolkachev, with an agent who looks to be, you know, the golden goose, who looks to be the real deal. I mean, someone who'll become known as the billion-dollar spy because of the kind of secrets he's got access to. The question, though, is can they run him? Can they meet him? Can they keep him safe? I mean, he is a man who's going to be under intense pressure himself and who is putting his life on the line to do this and to provide those secrets. We'll find out next time on The Rest is Classified.
See you then. Thanks for listening.